Hey, Femme Freak Radio heads. Pandemic Summer 2.0 has wound down. Now that it's fall, it's time for you to snuggle up with the feminist pop culture analysis you can only get from your good friends at Feminist Frequency Radio. And you know what would make everything even more cozy? Cuddling up with the community of listeners and supporters over on Patreon. Subscribers get early access to new episodes, bonus content, merch discounts, listener polls, and the occasional surprise treat. But when you sign up on Patreon, you won't just be supporting our feminist media analysis. You'll also be giving real, tangible support to our incredible Games and Online Harassment Hotline, which is our free, confidential, text message-based emotional support hotline. Head on over to patreon.com/femfreak to sign up now.
Anything that you bring to it and any reading that you make of it is a reflection of you. And I thought that was interesting after when I was just thinking through like all of the nudity, all of the gratuitous view, even us looking through the window with the young boys, looking at them changing. I think you're supposed to feel gross and uncomfortable and unsettled because it is gross and uncomfortable and unsettling.
Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love. I'm Anita Sarkeesian, and I'm joined today by a very sexy telephone operator, Ebony Adams.
What's up, everybody?
On today's episode, we're wrapping up a somewhat spooky October as we talk about the classic 80s slasher cult hit, Slumber Party Massacre. Stay tuned.
The party begins at 8 o'clock, but be on the lookout for an uninvited guest. When the pizza arrives, things really start jumping. One thing's for sure, no one's getting any sleep the night of the Slumber Party Massacre. Close your eyes for a second and sleep forever.
Hello, everyone. We're so excited to have you here. And we're even more excited to have our special friend, Jessica Zollman, back as our guest to talk about all things horror.
Hi,
what's up, Jess?
Hey, how's it going?
I was like, it's October. We got to bring you back.
Yeah.
This is your time to shine.
I'm the Halloween queen.
I'm so excited for this. Jess, I've been looking forward to this for months and months. Like, we knew we were going to ask you to come back. So I'm going to do something I never do, which is shut up and just listen. So bring me the goods.
I have so many horror questions. So this is basically just going to be like an interview. It's going to be great.
I can't wait.
But in case people have forgotten, every October you watch 31 days of horror films. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So, not an original tradition that I invented. It's something that folks have been doing for a long time. I would say even in like Blockbuster days, pre-Reddit being established, but definitely became a theme for the Reddit horror subreddit, and something that honestly, I've always been a horror buff. My username across the internet for a very long time has been JZombie. Zombie movies are my favorite genre of film for, you know, just classic childhood trauma reasons. It's fine. We don't have to get into that. And I think it just kind of spiraled from there. I like scaring myself. I like having nightmares. I have problems, you know, classic horror buff things. And so I gave myself a challenge. I think it started in 2019 to watch a horror movie every day. 2019 was a like no holds barred, no rules, watch whatever you felt like watching. It got a little complicated and tiring, so I started making themes. So every single week has a theme, and this year's themes were young adult week one, diversity, so diverse stories, diverse directors, diverse writers, and then this week that I'm currently on has been modern. So any movie made in 2021, sometimes I dip into 2020. And next week will be rewatch slash classics. So I've never seen Nosferatu, for example. That'll be one that I'm watching next week, finally. Kind of paying homage to the OG stories. So yeah, it's delightful. I share my ratings. 5 moons total is the best on my Instagram highlights at JZombie. If anyone wants to check them out, they're all queued up on there. If you want to
Yeah, and see, you also share your schedules on there too if people want to follow along or find new movies to watch.
You know, it shifts. Like, I did not feel like watching Candyman at the start of this week. It felt a little heavy, a little much. Things were really getting intense, so I put that off until tomorrow night, for example. So it's not set in stone, but I did share the entire month's kind of rough schedule. So if people wanted to follow along or if they just wanted to follow that, they could.
Yeah.
Do you do watch-alongs?
You know, I do. You
gather people and do like online watch-alongs?
I do. So my best friend, Kat, she still lives in Los Angeles. And we actually were roommates, neighbors to Anita as well. Mm-hmm. So fun little facts there. And, you know, pandemic has been hard. And one of the ways that we were able to stay connected was doing a movie night every Saturday. So for almost the last year now, we've been doing that. Mm-hmm. So she is joining me on the horror movie journey. She's not a big horror movie fan. So we've gone pretty easy. And the one serious quote unquote movie we saw, Bingo Hell, which just came out on Amazon, we watched at 4 p.m. because she just was not doing it at night.
Yo, hit me with that Zoom link, Jess. Let me creep on your horror movie watch along.
I got you.
It'll be extra creepy because I'll be off camera and just like breathing into the mic.
Perfect. It's perfect. Yeah, Kat does a lot of yelling, so it creates an ambiance.
Love it.
Amazing. Well, so y'all know that I'm not a big horror movie fan. I'm learning to navigate the space when it comes to things that aren't like, I don't like jump scares and I don't like a lot of gore, but there are other like I'm learning that horror is very broad and ranging. And so there are options for me. But Ebony, you're a big horror fan, right?
Yep. Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. But I think I'm the most irritating horror fan. So, Jess, you're probably going to, throw your mic down halfway through this pod and be like, you're debasing the genre. Because, I mean, one of the things that I love to do is just, like, spoil a movie before I go see it. Because I'm just fascinated. Oh, my, I say this every time. I apologize, Femme Freak listeners. You hear this every week from me. I'm just interested in the way they're built, you know? So, yes, there's like, you know, the visceral thrill of watching horror or reading horror, but it really for me is about the filmmaking, the craft of putting it together. And I have to say, I tend to get much more freaked out by horror literature than I do horror movies. You know, like there's just something about the way that I personally interact with horror on the page that like sticks in my brain more. And I'm not sure why that is. We'll unpack that in a later episode with my therapist.
Will your therapist come on to the Feminist Freak?
Hell no. Listen, my therapist barely has time for me, let alone our weirdo listeners.
I think spoiling it is totally fine, by the way. I actually think this is like the one genre that I fully encourage that. Like, there's no need for you to like not know the context in order for it to not be scary. Do you know what I mean? So I think it is a great example, especially the remake. I went in, I spoiled the whole production. I read all along. I needed to know everything. Mm-hmm. How are they approaching it? I think so much of horror comes from source material that it's, in my mind, totally fine because the visual elements and, like you said, the making of, the behind the scenes sometimes can actually be the interesting element of how this film gets made or why a film gets made. I won't do that for big, huge things like Marvel. Like, I don't even watch any of the trailers, but I think horror is the genre where if you're even a little timid and you want to know where the jump scares are, just read it. Just spoil it for yourself so then you can watch it and actually enjoy it.
Yeah.
And look, you'll probably still be fucking scared. Like, let's be honest. Yeah. If a film is like effective in what it's doing.
Exactly. But.
All right. Well, speaking of spoilers, we're going to enter Spoilerville here and start talking about this movie. Let me just introduce it really quick. Slumber Party Massacre hit screens in 1982 and since then has cemented its place as an iconic example of the slasher genre. In the film, a braless high school senior named Trish prepares to host an unsupervised slumber party with her equally nubile friends once her parents leave for a trip. A pretty creepy neighbor insists that he'll keep an eye on the kids, and no one thinks that this is weird at all. Because, you know, they're all 18. They make that very clear. Because in the world of this movie, it's actually not creepy, apparently. This film has everything. Teenagers who look like they're 35, horny teenage boys hitting on older women, slut shaming, and lesbian implications. Also, it has an escaped mass murderer, of course, in a Canadian tuxedo who kills everyone with a giant power drill. If you're wondering whether the girls spend the majority of the movie naked in a shower or wearing skimpy pajamas, they do. If you're wondering whether the soundtrack to some of the gory death scenes sounds like a porno film, it does. If you're concerned that there's nobody in the film who's not like the other girls and therefore more worthy of survival, there is. This film has it all. Boobs, boys, and strawberry daiquiris. I went down a bit of a rabbit hole sort of reading about this movie because I was so fascinated about it. So just a couple of things to sort of situate us. One, it was directed by Amy Holden Jones, who was a editor in Hollywood. That's kind of how she got her start. And she really wanted to be a director. So she got this opportunity to make this movie. And she turned down editing E.T. to make this, which I thought was like, you know, that's a choice that happens. Like, you don't know. You don't know what's
I
what.
I salute her
like,
for that choice. Living I'm happy her fucking she made dream, that choice. You know?
Also, you might notice that this script was written by Rita Mae Brown, which you might be like, that name sounds familiar. It sounds familiar because she's the writer of Ruby Fruit Jungle, which was this groundbreaking book about lesbians in the 70s, if you're into that literature phase. She wrote it originally to be a parody of slasher movies, but this wasn't made that way. I feel like what I've read debates that, but she was not happy with how this film, what they did with it and how it was done. So they basically rewrote it and changed it without her consent, but still gave her writing credit. So just a little bit of background about some of the nitty gritty of how it was made. This movie is deeply funny.
Like, oh, it's hilarious.
I was prepared to be like totally grossed out and freaked out. And I was like, oh, it's just... this is just a fucking comedy.
Yeah, genuinely a delightful film. I actually think of all of my watching so far, this has been, it was the most fun that I had watching a intentionally campy movie, because those are always fun for me. You know, Evil Dead's a favorite. So I think being able to say this genre is absurd and then make an entire movie literally surrounded by the male gaze as the evil thing, you know, loved it. Perfect. Chef's kiss.
Can we talk about when a genre or when a text resists satire, right? Because that's so crucial to what's going on here. And I think so this was the first time I had seen Slumber Party Massacre, and I'm wondering what it would have been like to watch it in 1982, you know, sort of, you know, when the genre is first getting its feet. And, you know, first becoming a thing, which is not to suggest at all that horror didn't exist in film before then, but this particular flavor of it, right? So it's new to you. You're seeing, you know, teenagers getting hacked to pieces. You're seeing a lot of people in underwear. There's lots of kissing. People are at camp, whatever, you know? And to be taking it so seriously while also recognizing that the genre itself, like, sows the seeds of its own parody, even as it's taking itself seriously. And I'm wondering how I would have received it in 1982 versus now in 2021, having seen everything that has come, that has been built upon the slasher genre since then. So it's even if I wanted to take it seriously, there's no way I could have, right? From the opening shots, you're like, oh, this is going to be some bullshit. And it is. It pays off in spades. I'm telling you, the film is an hour and 20 minutes. So it takes zero time to watch it. Go get your 7-day free trial of Shudder and watch this movie and, you know, feel like a creep as you watch these teenagers in the shower, teenagers in quotation marks, in the shower, you know, but it's so funny.
There's a documentary called Sleepless Nights, and it's about it's 20 minutes. It's about making of this movie. It's very badly done. It's fine. But one thing that I thought was interesting is that the director, Amy Holden Jones, talks about how she got an opportunity to make this movie in the, James Corman?
Roger Corman.
Thank you. And they were known for making these really sort of sexist, really gratuitous films. And so she's like, I had to do things in this in order to make this movie that I wanted to make. So she talks about that shower scene at the beginning, which is just like adult women who are pretending to be teenagers, like naked in the showers. Right.
And it takes a while. like, they're in the shower for a while.
They are. And she talked about how she didn't want to do that scene and that it was the least visually interesting because she just did it mechanically. She's like, I got to do this and I got to get through it, kind of. And I feel like that's really interesting because I watched it being like, God, this is fucking gross, right? Like, this is so, you know, there's a lot of things in this that are like deeply sexist, male gazey. And there's, you know, I'm it's interesting, Jay, that that you are talking about like the enemy is the male gaze, because that is the feminist reading of this. And I kind of want to get into that a little bit more, because to me, I'm like, sure, but also it's just doing it. Right. Like, it doesn't really feel like a critique of that to me as much as it's just like, look at these women, like women, they're fucking, look at these teenage young women who are like all getting undressed in front of the window in front of each other and then putting on their like little sexy nighties. And like these boys are watching them, but so are we, you know, like,
yeah.
It doesn't feel like a critique to me as much as just doing it.
That's fair. I think watching it, I took notes the whole time because that's how I do things in life that I need to think about deeply. And literally the first note is 2 minute titty shot. Like 2 minutes in, you see her boobs. And then again,
we literally paused it. I was watching with a friend and we paused it to be like, how soon did it get to boobs?
2 minutes.
It's I can't believe you're just going to mention my punk band name and not even give me a shout out, Jess.
2 minute titty.
Oh, that's a great
name. It's a good name. Man. Write that down. Well, and then it got to the shower scene and it pans down to the butt and you're literally focused while they're having a whole conversation on her butt for so long. My note says, are we sure a woman directed this? And honestly, afterwards, I read through my notes and had a moment where I was like, you know what? I felt like I was supposed to have that moment. And now hearing you with the context of her being like, I really didn't want to film that scene and I had to get through it. It felt like she was almost saying that, like she was almost leading us to be like, it's uncomfortable and you're supposed to feel uncomfortable. And it got to a point in my mind because it took place for so long. The shot was still for so long where I was just like, what are we doing? Like, what are we supposed to be doing here? It almost stopped being gratuitous and started just being, it's women in a shower. Anything that you bring to it and any reading that you make of it is a reflection of you. And I thought that was interesting after when I was just thinking through like all of the nudity, all of the gratuitous view, even us looking through the window with the young boys, looking at them changing. I think you're supposed to feel gross and uncomfortable and unsettled because it is gross and uncomfortable and unsettling.
I love Amy Holden Jones. And I don't want to suggest that she's being disingenuous in her sort of like modern, you know, explaining of how uncomfortable she was with this. But, okay, so you were upset by the shower scene. Were you also upset at having to film that 2 minute titty scene and then the lingerie scene and then everything else? And also, it seems to me that it's a bit rich to come in to the slasher genre knowing what the expectations are and saying like, well, I'm uncomfortable that I'm having to sort of uphold these generic expectations, you know, when the direction seems quite comfortable with embracing all of the rest of it, which she very well may have been like, okay, the shower scene is a bridge too far. But I don't know, like when placed alongside everything else that this film contains, I don't know. I'm not totally buying it.
Yeah, and there is something about both what you're saying, Ebony, is like what else was happening at this time and watching it in 1982 when it came out. And the other thing is like, what is our perspective of it now, especially as the people who worked on it and like, and not us, but like, yeah, she might be like using a different lens now to look at what she was doing. And remember, she was like really excited to be able to direct her first thing. So I feel like there's a lot of compromises that you're like, fine, it's fine, whatever, it doesn't matter kind of thing, you know?
I have not seen any of the other Slumber Party Massacre movies. I know you haven't, Anita, but Jess, have you seen any of the other ones?
I think some of
the sequels were also directed by women. And I would be interested, not interested enough to watch them soon, but to check out like what's going on. Because there is a place for women in genre that goes really unacknowledged, but whatever, we can get into that.
Yeah.
I want to get back to the question about the male gaze though, because the other thing I was thinking is like, who is this for? Right? And of course, we there's the sort of archetypal horror fan who is assumed to be like kind of a, you know, mouth breathing teenage boy. But imagine you're like a baby lesbian. It's 1982. This is a space in which you also get to enjoy seeing female bodies, you know? And there is a, there's no like rationale that you need to espouse for this. It's what's expected. And so the fact that you're enjoying watching this movie is unquestioned. And I mean, like, I don't want to overstate it here, but there's also something potentially transgressive in that, you know, like lesbian writer wrote this film, you know, like, I wonder how much of that is in there too.
Yeah. One of the first things I noted was that the first woman to die in this film was a woman telephone installation operator. Mm-hmm. And then not long after, you see a handy woman working on installing the peephole. Okay. And I was like, in 1982, would men have watched this and been like, what is that? You know, yeah. Like, who are they? Because that was a moment where I was like, oh, okay, like, I would not...
Oh, yeah, that handy woman with the gym teacher, which, yeah. Come on, we yeah. know that they're cosplaying each other. They are in love. They're a couple. That's okay, that's their role play. I was like, this is a whole different movie.
Maybe that's the second one.
There are two scenes that I think are just the best. No, three. Sorry, there's three scenes that I fucking adored in this, and one of them was the peephole drill.
Oh,
like,
my God.
That shit. And then she's just like, I drilled a hole in your door, bye. Mm-hmm. And you're like, what the fuck? But that was so well done. Like, I fucking loved that. But the other thing about this that I think is relevant here is that this movie feels like porn. Like, so much of it feels like heteronormative porn. So it's really, these are interesting things that we're like pulling out in terms of like giving it credit or trying to read things into it. Or maybe they are just there, right? Maybe it is text. But the whole thing is like, they make sure that they know that we make sure that the audience knows that they're 18. So when we see their boobs, they're not children, right? Mm-hmm. They're not underage, quote unquote, or whatever. I don't know why quote unquote, but you know what I mean? And that, like, it's all bad dialogue and bad acting, and there's all these gratuitous shots. Like, it just, the whole thing feels like heteronormative porn. And also, I would argue that, like, the sort of sexy telephone repair woman is a part of that fantasy, yeah, a little bit, yeah, you know? So, like, you know, this is me arguing that, like, is it really critiquing the male gaze, or is it just fucking doing it, right?
I so wanted the gym teacher to like save the day, like the lesbian gym. Then I was like, oh, come on.
I was hoping that was going to happen.
You know, like, we're so close. We are so close to having that happen.
Oh, the other thing is I was watching with my neighbor and we kept being like, wait, which one is that? Wait, who is that? Is that the sassy one? Is that they all look exactly the fucking same, mm-hmm, except the one, I think she was black. Who shows up like near, like, at the slumber party, and she's the only one wearing like that sexy like negligee thing.
She was my favorite. Listen, because that's me, not in the sexiness, but in the eating to calm myself down. When she started using the dead delivery guy as a table,
dead delivery.
I fell off the couch.
Hold on, we got to explain this for people who haven't seen
definitely.
It. So one of the, like, you know, jump scares that happen is they're like, oh, we ordered pizza, and they open the door, and the delivery guy has his eyes drilled out and like falls. Right. And they're like, ah, this is so scary. So they pull him into the house and lock the door, and they're like freaked out because now they know that something's happening. And she's like, okay, how long do we have to wait? Because, like, I'm getting hungry. And she actually goes, pulls the pizza out from under this dead dude's body, puts it on top of him, and uses him as a fucking table to eat her pizza. And it was
classic.
It was one of the most best scenes of this.
I feel like it should be the scene for gig economy workers on strike, to be honest. I had a moment where I was like, this is a metaphor for the gig economy. Like, what?
Yeah.
so good.
Absolutely.
Remember, she's also the one making those strawberry daiquiris. She just like, I'm here. I'm not here for a long time, but I'm here for a good time.
Survival mode, for sure.
The third best scene for me was the fridge scene.
Yeah.
So there's a scene where someone comes in from the house, like a neighbor comes over, and she's like, she keeps opening the fridge and doesn't see what's inside, and it's one of the dead character, like one of the dead slumber party participants. And
her name was like Kim, Anita. Her name was Kim.
Whatever.
They have names.
She gets stabbed in the stomach or whatever. She like is falling in and out and in and out of the fridge, and it's so well shot and so well done. Mm-hmm. And like, it was just, I was like, yep, that landed for sure.
I had a question partway through, which was, are these, including the young boys, all like high school teenagers cosplaying as straight people?
It's a question.
Because if you watch the film and you, because I know this was what I did as a teenager, I dated boys, even though I was also into women. I had, you know, mm-hmm. a fake straight relationship. So when I was dating my friend, nobody knew, you know, like I know mm-hmm. what I went through. And that was in early 2000s, late 90s. Can't imagine the 80s were any better. And I had a moment where I wrote, are the male characters supposed to be somewhat effeminate? Because they do have these moments where they are like really buddy-buddy and it feels like they are kind of playing this bit of like, we're really into this. And then same with these female characters who are like these, you know, volleyball. Hello, that's a sport you picked on purpose. And
yeah.
And I had a moment where I was like, are they all cosplaying and later they're just going to be best friends, like, you know, helping each other have babies through artificial insemination? Like, I don't know. It's possible. Yeah. And I do think if you watch it with that lens, it also gives it a very interesting angle and an interesting, mm-hmm. you know, element. Just something that I picked up on, especially when they were in the kitchen and she's like flirting with one of the boys. And I was like, she's not into this.
Well, and also the villain, right? The mass murderer like has a giant drill that he regularly holds as a phallic, like as a symbol for penis. And he's like jabbing it into people.
The scene in the garage. Like,
there's a lot of.
The scene in the garage where it's from behind him standing with his legs separated and it's between his legs. And then he drilled into the gal with her boyfriend who they were going to go run off and bone because it wouldn't be a horror movie if that weren't happening. That scene was iconic. For sure.
But don't worry, folks. He is symbolically castrated when the machete. What? Why is there a machete in the house? Anyway,
so
good. A machete, you know, cuts his drill in half.
What? I'd love to hear from both of you, like, how this fits in with your understanding of how slasher has evolved. Or, like, I don't know, just a little, is there, like, context around how to interpret this from our perspective today?
Jess, you should go first because anything I have to say is purely my bananas theories.
I love that.
It's not backed up by evidence.
I will start by saying I am not a huge slasher fan. I think movies like this, movies like Scream, are far more up my alley. I don't love Nightmare on Elm Street. I don't love Jason.
It's terrifying.
It's just, I I'm firmly zombie. I would say like science fiction is really more where I...
Sorry, quick question.
Yeah.
Is slasher like the, like everybody gets murdered and picked off? Like, is it always gratuitous? Is it just that everybody dies? Like, what is the boundary of slasher?
I think there's usually a hero or a heroine. There is a main character who will survive. If you think of,
like the final girl kind of.
Yeah. Movie. Or like House of a Thousand Corpses or Texas Chainsaw Massacre. There's someone that's either going to get away or that you're rooting for. Jamie Lee Curtis is that person in the Halloween, you know, series. And so there's going to be someone that you want to win. And then there's also this idea of who is the bad guy. The bad guy or the bad person usually is a character that they're trying to figure out or they're trying to come up with a why or they have a narrative. So this Slumber Party Massacre plays really well into that by in the beginning setting up the radio you know station saying this mass murderer has escaped or is I think either escaped or was let out served his sentence. I don't know how that's possible, but it's Los Angeles in the 80s, so I guess anything is really honestly possible. And so there's this idea of like this backstory and then also sometimes no explanation. There's no reason why. It doesn't really matter why. It's this is the way that it is. Scream, I think, does a good job playing into that. especially with their reveals. So yeah, I think that this played well into it, especially as a parody. And it had all of the elements, right? They run upstairs. That's it. You have to run upstairs. Someone has to run away where there's no escape and then try and block the door. It definitely was checking off all of the boxes, hiding in the basement. Where are you going to go? What are you going to do? You might find a weapon. That's a common one. So from my knowledge as a viewer, but not fan of this specific horror genre, it felt like it had all of the right elements.
I love the slasher genre precisely because it's so ridiculous and over the top. And because, you know, due to my own personal sort of like no-goes, it is easier for me to maintain like the requisite amount of like psychic distance from the threat. So, you know, as Jess was saying, like in the slasher genre, it tends to be like a singular villain, you know, usually coded as, you know, psychopathic, sociopathic, whatever, but it is a very ultimately banal threat, and it's a worldly threat. It's not supernatural. It's not contagion. You know, it's something that ultimately can be defeated, and it usually, you know, resides like in the body of one person, usually male, right? And so one of the reasons that I loved Slumber Party Massacre is that, again, you can see the genre sort of, you know, finding its feet in these early days and not quite knowing what is going to be solidified into canon. So yeah, there's going to be a final girl, but what does that mean? And so, you know, ultimately we have, oh God, I don't even remember her name because she was so boring. But the girl who survives,
Valerie?
And then, yeah, and her younger sister, who actually was also a big favorite of mine, just a complete fucking nut in the way that 14-year-olds are. But there's so many characters that the film is not completely adept at distinguishing, but gives them enough of a personality that you're like, I think I know who this person is from scene to scene. They're not just killer fodder. And yet I also couldn't tell you their name or, you know, what's behind them, whatever. We don't get enough time with like the villain, Russ or whatever. We don't get enough time with him to really know enough about like his history, his backstory, whatever. So he's an enigma, but not a really interesting enigma, you know, throughout. So yeah, it's just, it's interesting because it seems like, you know, and I don't want to suggest that like the filmmaking is amateurish, but it does seem like a very early kind of example of, you know, what's going to happen, you know, later on in the slasher genre. I don't know. I just, this film, y'all, I was delighted from minute one to minute two, the 2 minute teddy mark, to minute 87.
Can we talk about his monologue?
Please,
the I love you. It takes a lot of love for a person to do this. You know you want it.
Yeah.
That one?
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. My notes were, I hate this monologue. And not in like a, this is bad writing, in a, this is the creepiest. Like, this is every phrase I've heard in my life as a woman, from creepy older dudes when I was younger, even my creepy neighbor when I was younger. I just was, it sent chills down my spine. It was so good and also so bad.
Well, it does not help that the acting in this movie is, it is not even community theater level.
No.
Apologies to y'all that participate in community theater. It is, oh boy. It's like, so, these people just got the script that day.
Yeah.
In the documentary thing, it's on YouTube. I'll link it. You can just look up Sleepless Nights, Revisiting the Slumber Party Massacre. The guy who plays the villain talks a lot about how he used all of these acting techniques.
And did he?
Yes. And how he was like, it was his first role and he was
You're
really
kidding.
Proud of it. And he put a lot into it, and how he used all of these techniques, like the Strasburg be an animal. So he like walked like a peacock, and how he and how he was like, he read something about like these murderers who just say that they love their victims. So he just held on. And every time I like stabbed them, I was like, I love you. I love you. I love you. And I was like, Sorry, I'm trying. I don't want to make fun of this guy because, like, acting is a thing and it's like hard and real
it's
and
art.
Whatever.
It's hard,
but also very hard. But also, like, the seriousness in which he like discussed this role as like a very serious role was it's a little hard to not be like, all right, buddy.
He really channeled Nick Cage there with that take, huh? Wow, yeah.
And then they kept cutting to him like walking with his legs like that, like you can't see. I mean, they can see what I'm doing, but walking with his legs like kind of like poking around and like turning his head in very like intentional ways. And he's like, "Yeah, that was like me being a peacock." And I'm like, "Okay, buddy."
There, nothing delights me more when people Garth Marenghi their way through horror and just invest it with like way too much gravitas and don't quite achieve what they're hoping for.
Here's the thing is like, hell yeah. Like what, who cares? If you were an actor, put everything in every role. Like you've got it. Like that's the way that you're going to get discovered. That's the way you're going to have opportunities. That's what you're going to have for your reel, all that shit. But like as an adult human now looking back on it, like that's your take. Like that's the part that I don't get.
This gets at something like you mentioned, Jess, like the campiness of this film, right? And it's important to tease out like active camp versus passive camp and like, you know, camp that knows what it's doing. And so at some level can be perhaps a little bit unsatisfying because it comes with it, you know, with that side order of cynicism, versus like passive camp where something is trying so hard for a grandiosity that it just cannot achieve.
I mean, and it is The Room is a so cult delicious. Classic for a reason, right? There's a reason why The Room is still showed at small single theater movie.
Yes.
It's they do not know. They are not aware.
Yeah.
So, and it's what makes it a perfect horrible movie, and I think bless his heart for thinking he did a great job, because I think it actually makes the movie better.
It is heartbreaking sometimes to watch like when he's not playing along with the joke anymore and you see like the confusion and the hurt in his voice. Oh, I'm so sorry. But he just is like, I really put my heart and soul into this, you know? And he thinks he did something. And he did do something. But, oh, God bless. Love it. Love it.
I also think this movie did a great job in the trope of setting up the we're going to film this thing because you should know that it's going to come into play later. So in the very opening scene, they filmed the window. So I even wrote, I'm like, he's going to come in through the window. And then they go into the backyard and I'm like, someone's going to die in the pool. And then they go into the garage and I'm like, oh, garage door opener is going to be a part of this somehow. They did a really great job making sure you know, we're going to show you the thing because later on that's going to be important. So
right.
What I found interesting about the pacing is that, like, you almost right away murder happens, right? Like, just immediately, like, and you see the guy, like, it's not even like he's in the shadow. Like, the repair woman gets, like, pulled into the van and then, like, fuck, and you're like, oh. And so then you have, like, a series of murders. And then you just have, like, a long stretch of just, like, is it going to happen? When's it going to happen? Is it going to happen? And then, like, not even just like hanging out. Like it was just for me, the pacing was really, and then it was like Massacre Central. Right. But there was just a big chunk in the middle where they were literally just having a slumber party. You're like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
With hanging out with friends, drinking strawberry daiquiris.
It's the early 80s.
Listening to some Gino Vannelli, having a good time with your girlfriends.
I can't believe you've never invited me over for a strawberry daiquiris and a slumber party, Ebony.
Why would, I don't know why you're surprised by that. I don't leave my house or invite people over to my house. These are constants with me.
Overall, I have tension between the sort of feminist analysis side of me being like, this is like gratuitous sexism, but also it was just really funny and like a goofy movie if you want to like sit around and like goof around with friends. You know what I mean? It's not something you're going to sit and like talk, like be very straight and turn the lights out and don't talk through this thing, right? Like you're going to be like, you're literally going to pause it and be like, yep, 2 minutes in, there was a boob, you know? So that's my take on it is like, yeah, it's kind of, It's weird and it's awkward and it kind of feels like porn, which is uncomfortable, hetero porn, but also like, it also was kind of fun, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you're, you know, unfortunately in a situation where you don't feel comfortable exploring your lesbianic desires, become a horror fan, because it's very easy to see naked women in horror. This is terrible advice. People do not listen to me.
What the fuck? You're so fired from this podcast.
No, I'm telling you, like, this is...
There's so many other ways to explore your sexuality than, like, gratuitous male gaze.
Obviously, I'm being facetious. Obviously, I'm being facetious. But seriously, like, I don't want to discount the way that this film is going to be received differently by different audiences, right? Like, we can't, you know, just suggest that there's a singular audience. Yeah. And I am really interested in, like, what would it have been like to be a 15-year-old girl going to the movies to see this and be like, oh, all right, well, you know, Johnny sitting right next to me is getting kind of excited at this, but I'm also getting excited. What does that mean? You know?
Yeah, I genuinely wish that this was a rewatch for me and that I had seen it at that, even at 18, too. Because I do feel like I probably would have appreciated it or enjoyed it in a very different perspective than I did now, you know, kind of watching it as a fully realized adult who's comfortable with myself.
Right. And doesn't need to see human bodies, female bodies in peril to, you know, exactly. See a boob.
Exactly. I'm curious, though, about, like, this wasn't the only movie that was doing shit like this.
No.
Well, I guess it's because we are talking about this particular movie, but it's not like there was a dearth of like scantily clad women in films at that time, you know, like there would have been more opportunities for someone who was questioning their sexuality to have that exposure. Well, in cinema.
Especially before 1984. I mean,
because this isn't queer. This movie's not queer.
No, very much not. I mean, maybe baiting minorly if you know better and you can like read into it, but not. It's not a queer film for sure. So 1984 is when PG-13 was introduced. Until then, it was either PG or R. Those were the two buckets, and you could get down to PG if you deleted a couple. A murder scene here, a swear word there. So definitely in 1982.
Deleted.
Deleted. I guess it's cut and you're actually filming at that point too. But because the rating system had not caught up, you know, it took Gremlins and it took, what was the other one? Red Dawn, I think, before PG-13 actually became a rating. So yeah, plenty of opportunities where movies that were rated PG that should not have been rated PG were being viewed by kids that really should not have been seeing some of these movies.
But I think, like, I'm sure someone has done this, and if not, I'm going to try and get a grant to do it. If you were to count tit scream time in film, I guarantee you it's longer, it's more robust in horror films, you know, because we are exactly. So you're allowed to like gaze upon the body for much longer. It's on offer to you. And you're allowed to see much more of the body, you know, without having to rationalize your enjoyment of the film. It's part and parcel of it. And so, you know, no, I don't want to suggest that like everybody who's watching porn is using it to get off, but I do think like there's a way in which it feeds a need, but it's not, you know, perhaps completely honest about all of the needs that it's feeding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's also an element of vulnerability too, I think. Mm-hmm. Heightened vulnerability, you know, you're already in a situation where your safety is compromised. Let's just make it even more aggressive and extreme, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it's a way of pushing a boundary of our own comfortability, you know, it's the worst case. It's you're in your home alone and you're choking, you know, it is that fear that you kind of have of like, is someone watching me out the window? I can't see out when it's light in my
house.
As I
make strawberry daiquiris in my skimpy nightie.
Is a bloody Barbie going to show up? I don't know.
Do you remember when we were neighbors and I choked on a boba and I was like, I could have died and no one would know. And then I'd just be here dead.
I do remember.
Choking on a boba. Although it's a pretty good way to
choke on a boba.
I'm going to choke on a food item. Like, you know, that'd be fine.
I know the Heimlich.
It's the perfect murder weapon because eventually it would dissolve, right? And when they found it, they'd be like, what?
Yeah, nobody would know.
It's the icicle murder weapon. That's the whole.
I'm going to write this right now.
You take an icicle.
Yeah. All right, y'all.
Yeah.
we'll be right back with some freakouts.
Hey there, podcast family.
While you're enjoying the show today, why not head on over to Patreon and sign up to be part of the crew that makes the magic happen? That's right. When you become a subscriber, you offer us the help we need to keep making the show. So moonwalk on over to patreon.com/femfreak and sign up today. And now, back to the show.
Now it's time to talk about what's been thrilling us, moving us, upsetting us, or infuriating us this past week. I think Jess is going to bring up some shit around Batman, and we thought maybe this would be a good opportunity to do a little baby pop culture roundup. We could talk a little bit about what's been going on, because there's a couple things that I think is worth shouting out right now. So, Jess, why don't you kick us off?
So, the Batman trailer dropped. The Batman. I like when I say it like that. It dropped this week. Look, I'll admit it. Huge fan of Robert Pattinson. Can't help it. I like Twilight. I saw it all in the theater. What do you want from me? Please judge me. Do it. Just do it. It's fine.
You do know that when I was one... whatever. I have a friend that lives in Stockholm, and whenever we're together, we always watch the worst movies, and we watched all the Twilight movies in like a day and a half, and
that's
it was a painful... Like, I thought
garbage.
It was going to be like fun, and I was like, this is really... Don't recommend doing it.
The soundtrack is the best part of every film. So anyway, I watched it because I was interested because I like him. And I'm over it. I'm over Batman. I'm done. And I will say Ali Barthwell, who I follow on Twitter, WTF Flanksteak, retweeted this thread from 2020 by Sean Kelly, whose username is Story Slug. And it starts, just the start is, one of the big problems with dark and gritty Batman movies is that people writing them can't craft a mystery that's so complex only Batman can solve it. So Batman's, quote, superpower ends up being, quote, the ability to violate people's constitutional rights. And then it just devolves from there into how Batman can't be scary when also the police have riot gear. Batman's whole thing is that he's got the tanks and he's got the tear gas and he's got all these equipments that none of the police have. And so that's how he's cleaning up Gotham. But now there are no rules for police. Police can do whatever the fuck they want. Vigilantism is encouraged and rewarded in modern times. And so we need a new Batman and we need a new plot. And Batman should really be actually going after corrupt cops. That should be what he does in order to save and clean up Gotham, not doing the thing that cops in real life are already doing. And it was such a good thread, and it got me really riled up because Poison Ivy is a climate crisis activist. I am not supposed to be against her. That doesn't make sense, you know? And we've all watched Joker, and we know it's this anti-capitalist, you know, when there isn't mental health support for people, they devolve into the dark corners of their psyche. I'm also not supposed to agree with him, you know, quote unquote, supposed to. And so this idea that the people that are the bad guys are actually the ones that are right, it's just no one's listening to them.
Wouldn't it be dope if going off of that, wouldn't it be great if someone actually, like, if DC had the nerve to actually make Batman the villain, like, just fully, like, no, you know, don't pull any punches there, just, like, do it.
Batman's the bad guy.
They're not going to, but...
No. In my mind now,
Batman... I don't think you guys are giving billionaires the proper respect.
Yeah. But yeah, Batman is Elon Musk in his war to ride to space and then yell at everyone being like, you just don't care about space. And it's like, that's not what this is about. You're the stupidest person. So I can't be on the side of a metaphor for Elon Musk, really. That just goes against everything I believe in. And so, yeah, I thought I would be excited about the Batman trailer, and instead I was... so frustrated that this is where we're at in a comic book character's arc, basically.
Yeah, so I got really excited because a local cinema here is going to be playing Batman Returns, and that movie's fucking
so
awesome.
Good. The best.
And I've never seen it on the big screen, so I'm excited about that. But it got me thinking, especially around this stuff, and what we were just talking about with James Bond a few episodes back, of like this attempt to make these bigger than life characters and superheroes like dark and gritty and brooding and the sort of anti-hero trend that I'm like, are we done with this yet? Like, what? Like, if we're going to reboot Batman again, because DC has had a very bad run of their films. So, like, can we do something different? Like, does it have to be this brutish, dark, intense thing where, like, Batman wasn't always like that, you know? And the Batman movies weren't, I mean, well, look, I think Batman's a problem to begin with. I think Batman's always a problem. Like, but I'm thinking more about like, okay, if we're continually rebooting these franchises that we have these emotional relationships to, can we try a different tone? Can we try a different structure? Can we do something? Can we just take a little, some chances here, you know?
Yeah. No, that's not going to happen because we are living in a moment in which masculinity takes itself so seriously and refuses so to be the object of the joke or the subject of the joke, right? And so you have like Tim Burton's Batman coming, what, 20 years after Adam West's Batman, but there's an element of fun and humor and a sense that like we recognize how ridiculous this is. And then you get George Clooney and Val Kilmer and what's his name? You're done in this town professionally. What's his name? Y'all know who I'm talking about. Newsies.
Oh, Christian Bale.
Christian Bale, right. Yeah. Okay.
Listen, I forgot about that one.
I don't know.
I took it out of my
mind. But I'm saying like we have entered a moment in which like cis white men on screen have to be taken so seriously. Yeah. In these kinds of roles, you know? So yeah, we're gonna continue to get bullshit like the Batman. I am honestly surprised that Robert Pattinson signed up for this because he seems like a weird dude. And so I don't know what would have attracted him to this because there's no way he's gonna get to play Batman as a weird dude.
I mean, oh, yeah, I'm sure he's getting loads of fucking money for this.
Fabbing, but he's been offered other things, I'm sure, like this before, post Twilight, right? So why Batman? I mean, he's already talked about how he doesn't want to like work out for it, you know, and all of that stuff. And it's like, did you not understand the assignment? That's what this all is all about.
So that's actually interesting. Then I'm actually really curious how that's going to play out. Like maybe there is a thing around who's directing this. Like maybe there's a relationship between Robert Pattinson and the director of like Batman's going to be weird.
No, I don't think so. I don't think. Like, DC has too much to lose by taking a gamble, you know? They're going to have him in, like, a muscle rubber suit.
Yeah, well, yes. You can fake a lot in a muscle rubber suit, apparently. Anyways, that is a curiosity. And, like, maybe is it a challenge for him that he's just like, who knows? Who fucking? I'm sure there'll be 5,000 interviews. Also, could you imagine taking on these roles and then having to be like as an actor, if you just want to act, like you can't, right? Especially if you take this on. Now you are like all the press junkets and everyone's going to want to talk to you about all the different things for fucking ever. And like how many like movies did he sign up for, right? You can't just sign up to be Batman once. Like that's not the way that shit works. Fascinating.
Maybe it's an op. Like maybe he plans to go in and be so terrible that it finally disrupts the franchise. And they're like, we can't make any more of these for a while.
We've had so many bad Spider-Man movies that like that doesn't work.
We're about to get them all at once. So I hope you're ready for that.
So, okay, other fun fact about, because Spider-Man got me thinking about Tom Holland. I am very late to the game that Tom Holland is playing Nathan Drake in the Uncharted movies, which feels so bad to me. Like, I really sincerely like Tom Holland, and I love him as Spider-Man, and I think that he's just a very, he's got that thing for me as a performer, as an actor, and Nathan Drake is a piece of shit. And I'm just like, but you're my little Spider-Man baby. And you do the umbrella dance thing, you know? Like, what are you doing, man?
I think this is a moment where he just wants to be viewed as like an adult and a serious adult actor. Because I think a lot of people think of him as like, you're the cute little boy who goes under the Iron Man's wing. And so I'm sure this is just a moment of like, I can be an adult man with a wife.
It just, Nathan Drake is such a piece of shit. Like, such an, like, I agree that that is probably a factor in this. It's probably a great opportunity. It's a series, you know, whatever. But it's just that Nathan Drake is such a cocky piece of shit.
Yeah.
That I just don't, like, I don't know. It'll be interesting. And maybe, I do think he's a really good actor. And so maybe he will be that be that guy in this and it'll land and then I'll be like, oh, gross. You know, like, because I'm not going to like it, whoever played, like, you know, Henry Cavill as The Witcher is like, I just fucking hate Henry Cavill and I hate the character The Witcher, and you played it well because you're both fucking dicks.
It was a match made in heaven. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So anyways, yeah. Ebony, do you want to bring up anything, any other pop culture-y news stuff?
We don't have a lot of time to talk about it, but I would encourage folks, if you don't know about the what is now an averted strike action, but the demands being made by IATSE, which is the entertainment craftsperson union, please go check it out. You listen to a pop culture-focused podcast, none of the stuff that we talk about would be possible without the folks behind the scenes making the magic happen. And they are not asking for diamond toilets here. They're asking for reasonable working hours. They are asking for the opportunity to get a decent night's sleep, to have fucking meal breaks, you know? We should all be in solidarity with them. So please, if you haven't checked out IATSE's list of demands and what's going on, please, please check that out and, you know, make your voice heard and support unions. But also, while you're at it, please check out what's going on with the Netflix walkout that was this Wednesday, organized by their trans employee resource group, and the things you can do to support that that group of employees and the trans and queer community, because it's important that we make our voices heard there too. I want to make it clear, the employee resource group is not asking for a boycott of Netflix, but they, and so, you know, the cardinal rule is you don't engage in a boycott if the organizers don't call for that. Like, don't just go off half-cocked. So just familiarize yourself. This is not like, you know, I'm asking you to go read somebody's doctoral dissertation. I think The Verge has got, like, the Netflix ERG demands. Just go check it out. Like, become aware of what it takes to make the media that you enjoy and, you know, the culture in which we all exist and how we cannot be so shitty to each other. Okay, thanks. Bye.
I recommend following the IATSE stories on Instagram. If you don't know any, like, even if you do know about the film industry, but even if you don't, like, these stories they're breathtaking in the worst possible way. Like, the treatment that people have endured on set and the crews have had to endure are, you know, like, we could sit here and talk all day about, like, you know, high level, how, you know, really punishing it is. And working on a movie and TV shows is hard in the best of conditions. And these stories are heartbreaking. And I encourage you to check them out and not, you know, not hide from them, because I think it's important to know that, like, it's not okay. The things that we love and enjoy are being made by people who are being, like, tortured, really.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of, like, it's
definitely
it's
exploited.
Not okay.
Exploited, yeah.
There recently was a safety lapse on a set in San Antonio, and a DP was killed, I believe, today.
Yep.
Also worth looking into and reading about. Mm-hmm. This is bringing up a lot of memories of Bruce Lee's son, Brandon Lee, dying on the set of The Crow, which was a devastating experience. Based on a safety lapse with blanks, which are not, they're not empty. Blank doesn't mean an empty chamber in a prop gun. It's still firing something, and it can be a huge hazard. And any of these employees working under the conditions that they're working in with 10, 12-hour days and limited sleep and no food, it's very possible to make simple mistakes that cost people's lives. They're all interconnected. They're all related. And it's worth knowing what conditions people are working in order to make art that we get to critique.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, y'all. We want to hear what you're thinking about. So submit your own freakouts at feministfrequency.com/freakout. That's FREQOUT. Thanks so much for listening to Feminist Frequency Radio. Just wanted to acknowledge, I forgot to do this at the top of the show, that last week we didn't release an episode because our audio got haunted and corrupted, and it was a fucking nightmare trying to make this work. So we just ended up scrapping it, which, selfishly, I actually prepared for that fucking episode, like, really did my homework on that one. And we had a great guest, but we'll have her come back and do that again. So thank you for bearing with us in our technical difficulties. Jess, Thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find out more about you?
Yeah, I'm online, jzombie.com is where you'll find my photography work. And if you want to look at my Halloween playlist, it's on my highlights on Instagram, jzombie, J-A-Y-Z-O-M-B-I-E. And you can come check out some of my pretty photos. I don't post them very often. I'm mostly in stories, so I won't overwhelm you, but it's not like you'd see anything in the feed anyway.
Jay is one of Jay. Why do I call
you? Call me Jay. I mean, that's, you know.
But I've never done that before. It's because one of the staff members at Feminist Frequency is Jay, and it's just like sticking in my brain. Jess is one of my favorite photographers. Just really stunningly beautiful colors, very vivid. So please go check that out, and you know, hire her.
That would be great. I would love that. Please, if you if you work for an ad agency and need photos for your brand, hello.
Yeah. Jess is the one for you. If you stick around and listen to the bonus, we will hear more from Jess, who will be joining us there as well. Next week, we're going to be talking about Dune, which I am not excited for. And I think Ebony is low-key excited for.
High-key excited. High key, are you kidding? Great. What?
It doesn't look good, man. I just don't know what to say.
I'm
going to
come
out
there and fight you right now. It looks fucking great.
Are you going to go to the theater to watch it, or are you going to watch it on HBO?
I'll be going to the theater. All right. I'm soaking up all of that goodness. Baby Timothy Chalamet, weighing all 14 pounds of him. Love that kid. Love that kid.
Yeah. Well, TBD on if I go to a theater or not, but I will be watching it and I will have opinions. And we're going to bring on special guest Jordan Cruciola of the Disaster Girls podcast to talk to us about it as well. Our show is engineered by Rob Parra. Carrie Stimson provides technical support. Artwork is by Jamie Varon. And our intro music is by Phil Circus. Thanks, y'all.
Bye.
Bye.